How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre. You're a part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well. Hope you're staying cool. I don't think anybody in the world is staying cool. I read a story today about the heat wave in Europe and Turkey, 120, 121 degrees. Mm-hmm. Birds were dropping out of the sky.
Wow.
It kind of cooked. It would just drop out of the sky.
Well, yes. Hopefully they weren't landing on runways. Wasn't there a runway just north of London where the asphalt was melting because it was so hot?
I believe that. Yes. I believe that.
Man.
It's wild. Okay.
Yeah. We're not doing well.
Okay.
No, we're not.
That's why you're in the Hall of Fame. Perfectly stated.
That's right. That kind of keen insight that you can only get from somebody like me.
And those wonderful voices you're hearing, award-winning Claude Jennings, David, who's going to join us for just a little bit because he's in an undisclosed location, but he's going to watch a baseball team that might actually win the game. And Mark Stern, our favorite visiting member of the Chatter and Books family. Mark, welcome back, honey.
It is so good to see everybody. I've missed you all very much, so it's great to see you. Even if it's only virtually, it does my soul good to see all of you.
It's becoming such a thing to do all things virtual now that when I see people in person, it's kind of odd.
Yes.
Do you FaceTime with them while you're in person just to make it feel more natural?
Just stand over there.
Right. I need to see you through a screen. Great. So, Mark, we want to hear, are you doing the City Open this year, which starts the tennis tournament? DC starts in 5 days, correct?
Yes. Actually, I am working. I hadn't worked in it a couple of years. Obviously, a lot of COVID reasons for that. Right. But I will be back on a limited basis. I'm going to be doing 3 days along with my buddy Scott Jackson. We're going to sort of split duties there. So I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, it's going to be fun. They got a terrific field. If I could be a shameless promoter of it a second.
Please do.
Let's see. Who did it? Taylor Fritz, who just had a great run at Wimbledon. He's going to be there. Jessica Pegula, who's a top 10 player. Emma Raducanu, who won the U.S. Open last year. Leila Fernandez, who lost her in the finals last year. Venus Williams is going to be there. Andre Rublev, who we didn't see play in Wimbledon. He's going to be there. Francis Tiafoe, who's a local favorite. Just all kinds of really, really great players. It's going to be an awful lot of fun. I'm very, very excited to be back there.
Is it a tennis federation rule that it has to be 9 million degrees during this tennis tournament? I've gone several times, and when the kids were little, we took them a couple times because it's a neat place. It's so hot, and you
so
can
also
watch so many players throwing up on the side of the court.
I remember there was a Russian player by the name of Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova, and she had never been to Washington, and she came and I saw her walking off court. She's like, what the hell's going on here? Like, what is this? Well, welcome to my world, man. This is what I live in. And some of the European players, now they're dealing with it obviously now with what's going on over there, but they come into this and they're so unprepared. I think a lot of them try and skip Washington and play in, there's a tournament up in Toronto right after this. And I think they do that. But there's also one that goes on in Cincinnati that's incredibly hot. It's a brutal, brutal lead up to the U.S. Open weather-wise.
Okay, how do you learn all the names, all the pronunciations?
Can I give you – all right, this is the inside truth. First of all, I get most of them wrong, and I am corrected. So I apologize all the time. But if you go to the individual tour websites, the WTA.com and ATP.com, you can look up the player, and then they've got like a little speaker button on the player profile page.
Smart.
And you hit that, and then they're saying, hi, my name is, you know, it's never John Smith. It's always something super complicated. But so you listen to that a couple of times, and you're like, well, that's how they said it, so that's how I'm going to say it.
Nice. Okay, David, NBA, some of the names get more and more challenging. Do they do that?
Well, not quite to that extent, but you ask them, hey, how do you pronounce your name?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And then they say it with an accent, so you can't understand them.
Yeah, well, sometimes you do. But most of the time you can figure it out. You know,
my name's Bird.
Ask your Bird trainer.
Or Bird, coach. Larry Bird. You know how to say Larry Bird?
Okay, who's going to win, Mark? Who's going to win the women's side? Who's going to win the men's side? Just singles.
Oh, wow. Well, you know what? I'm going to say Jessica Pegula. I think she's got a really good shot to win. I think she's playing really, really well. For the men, you know what I'm going to say, because I believe, and I'm looking through this to make sure he's coming, I think Nick Kyrgios is going to play, and he's a defending champion. Oh, I believe. Wow. I know he's won there before, so I'm going to say it's Nick Kyrgios.
There you go.
Yeah, that's my call.
Good. We got it written down.
Completely wrong, but it's fun.
All right. In just a little bit, we are going to be talking to Alex Kershaw, who is the be-all, end-all, the penultimate World War II expert, has written some fabulous books, including this one called Against All Odds, which is about four of the most decorated soldiers of World War II. Just, it's one of these books where you read and the detail he has, the stories he has, you go, okay, I'm going to stop complaining about traffic now, because it's just not quite the same stress and strains that these people went through. But we will talk to him. But first up is a couple of emails. David Aldridge, my absolute favorite David of all time, but this is maybe my second favorite David. And he sent an email that said, just finished Mecca. Do you remember that one, David and Claude? Susan Strait from California?
Oh, yes.
That was
one of our favorite guests. She was
one of our favorite guests. And Susan, if you're listening, because she tells me she listens sometimes, she's supposed to be in D.C. during August. So I hope to see her.
Oh, cool.
But David goes on to say Family Chow, which the author described as Succession in a Restaurant, is still my favorite book. Also very good. It's my favorite book in the last 6 months. Thank you for another great podcast last week. We'll never miss one. I appreciate you and the whole crew. David,
we like that. Can we find out where Susan's going to be and drink with her? I'd love to.
I will. I bet she drinks some pretty good drinks.
Absolutely.
I'm just getting. They might be homemade, you know, in some of those places she's lived in California. Okay. All right, Claude, this one is for you. This is from Mark Hanna. Remember we were talking about your golf expedition coming up?
Right.
Mm-hmm. This is from Mark Hanna. Some information for Claude regarding his upcoming trip. A number of years ago, I had the opportunity to travel to Bandon Dunes with a group of friends. While we were there, we actually ran into the architect of the Bandon Dunes course, David McClay Kidd. While talking to him, his comment that stood out was that he believes that the only difference between playing golf at Bandon Dunes and playing golf in Ireland or Scotland is that at Bandon Dunes, you have better beds and better food. I hope that he enjoys the trip as much as we did. It is a spectacular place for golf and bonding. Thanks for your wonderful show. That's lovely. Okay,
yeah.
Without revealing names, Claude, is this going to be a male bonding kind of thing you're doing?
Yeah, so we've got about, I think, 10 guys going. And we're really looking forward to it. And so the text chain that we have is increasingly getting, more frequent with stuff. And just even last night, I don't know why, it just dawned on me. Let me check the weather at Bandon, in August. We're looking at highs around 73 every day.
Ooh, nice.
Right on the coast, 73. So yes. I had to change out my entire, because look, when you've got the kid and other things, there are a few things you look forward to for yourself. So my bag's already packed. So I had to unpack the shorts. And I love my kid and love the family. But I mean, this is a me thing. So I had to throw in a few pants and, a cardigan or two to but we're looking forward to it.
Male golfers, again, as we've discussed, male golfing attire, which isn't great, is much better than the female golfing attire. But the men always have cool rain jackets and you put on those little sweater vests, the sleeveless sweater vests. I like those. Mm-hmm. That's always a nice look. Did you put in some sweater vests?
No. So no sweater vests. But the thing that I get closest as far as the sweaters, like I said, I'll go with the cardigan. I'll go with the button.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, nice. I'll do that. I'll go for a classic, I guess that's what, 1970s kind of situation. Mm-hmm. A few colors. Yeah, I'll do that.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Very, very nice. Chatter on golf attire next. Okay. Some book news. I've talked often on the show about Michelle Obama's memoir, Becoming, which is just an extraordinary book. And I'm pretty sure, I sent an email to someone today, but I haven't heard back, but I'm pretty sure her memoir, which has sold something like 18 million copies, bested her husband, Barack Obama's memoir. And Ron Charles was talking about this the other day. It's crazy. Sold something like 750,000 copies the first day it was out. So there is a lot of expectation for her next book, which is coming out soon, called The Light We Carry. Its first printing will be 2.75 million copies, the first printing. And she talks about overcoming challenges and how do we overcome challenges. This is from Ron Charles' piece on it. Michelle Obama says, how do we overcome? How do we overcome our fears? How can we channel our frustration into something positive? And how do we rekindle that flame that's inside each of us? And they've got some crazy, wonderful promotional plans and all that. But here's my question. I'll buy it in a heartbeat because the cliche, Michelle Obama writes the phone book now. I will read it because I think maybe it was one time lucky. I don't think so. But I think she brings something to her writing, which is pretty exceptional. So I'll buy it. Those kinds of topics, what are our inner demons? How do we connect all those things? To me, sound very much something that middle-aged women and older, I are one, would want to read. Claude's too young to answer this question, but David and Mark, any interest in this kind of book for Michelle Obama?
Some, sure.
Some, he stutters.
No, well, what I mean is that, any book that's about overcoming fear is worth reading. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily want to read it because it's written by Michelle Obama, although she's a very good writer. But I like reading books about people who have things that they can't get past and they get past them.
I enjoy that
because we all have those things, and sometimes you succeed and sometimes you fail. And I'm interested in the process.
Have you ever, okay, Mark, you answer the question, then I have a follow-up question.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I would agree with David in that, you know, I think sometimes, particularly as guys, I think we're like, I only deal with my own stuff, my own hurdles, and I got to figure out how to do it on my own. And sometimes you feel like you're on an island. And then when you hear something from somebody, you read something from somebody, it sheds light on it and it helps you get through something. So yeah, I obviously, when Michelle Obama speaks, it's something that you want to take interest in. But I don't know that I would read it cover to cover, but I would definitely be interested in seeing what she had to say. Is that a fair answer?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, follow-up question. Have you ever read any self-help books?
I have. I think it was called The Four Agreements, I think. Was that one?
Oh, that was, yes. What was that guy's name? Yes, I read that too. Actually.
Yes, I read it a while ago, and I remember being, wow, this really, it sort of like brought a lot of stuff into focus. And I don't read a lot of those books. I read, as you know, I read a lot of history.
Yeah.
So I sort my things out with Julius Caesar. So it's interesting for me to do stuff in the 21st century. But I really like that. That's one that really spoke to me. I do remember that one very vividly.
Wow. Okay, David.
Yes, I did read The Four Agreements. I remember reading that book. Don Miguel Ruiz, that's right.
There we go.
That's it. Yes, thank you.
And some other books of that ilk.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, again, I think real world, I love real world kind of exercises. I'm much more of a nonfiction guy than a fiction guy. So real examples of people overcoming. Like, I remember Evan Thomas's book about Bobby Kennedy, which was all about Bobby Kennedy overcoming his various fears of life.
Yeah.
That's really what the book was about. It wasn't really about him wanting to be president or being the attorney general. It was about this guy who was afraid of a lot of things and kind of almost foolishly threw himself head first into some of these things. But that's what I kind of gravitate to, is how do people overcome those? How do people get past, I always wanted to do this, but I was afraid to do it. For whatever reason, you're afraid to do something.
Sure.
So I'm interested in this stuff like
that. Yeah. Doesn't count as a self-help book, but Marie Kondo, the woman who organizes everything.
Sure. Oh, sure. Yeah. We talked about her before. Yeah. Yeah.
Changed my life in a very healthy way. And obviously it's very practical stuff, but it's also, it makes you really think about what's important or what's not.
It does. I mean, when you think about it, yes. Why do you still have things that you haven't worn in 10 years in your closet? Why?
Right. Because it's never going to fit again.
No, but even if it does, you clearly don't want to do what's necessary to fit into it again.
Exactly.
David, you said that. I forget, we were in studio at some point and you had talked about cleaning out your, you know, just clearing stuff out. And you said, if you haven't worn it in 10 years, you got to get rid of it. And listen, I credit you with that statement because that's how I live now. I'm like, you haven't worn this in a decade. Okay. The first George W. Bush, he was president when you went, so get rid of it. A great thing to live by. Yes.
It really is. And the other one, in a similar way, Dan Pink, we've had on the show a couple times.
Yes.
And he had that book called When, which is all about time and how you
regret, right?
Right.
And regret was the second one.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he disagrees with that book, saying I have no regrets. I have very few regrets. But he also, in a macro sense, made me really think about how I use my time. And I like to think I make good use of my time, but you became painfully aware of how much time you waste, you know, doing this on your cell phone and scrolling through. And it just made me much more aware and much more conscious and much more useful in how I take the time every day and try to make the best of it.
Yeah,
try. Right. A few weeks ago, I took TikTok off my phone.
That's probably a good time saver for you.
I've never watched TikTok, so I don't know what I'm missing.
Claude, TikTok ever?
No, I'm not. But I had a TikTok conversation a few days ago with my goddaughter, Jasmine. She's 13.
Ooh.
And she doesn't watch television. I mean, I'm not her dad. I'm not her mom. And if they want her on it, I can't do anything about that. But she doesn't watch television. She doesn't watch streaming services. all she watches, you know, she says, I'll cut the television on when it's time to go to sleep, because she uses the TV to go to sleep. But she just watched TikTok. People dancing and doing things. She doesn't. That's the only entertainment she watches.
The horrifying thing about TikTok is from A to Z, any topic, any issue, any person, any animal, any event, millions and millions. And, you know, with me, it's all puppy videos and somebody has to, David, you need, you're the word person. This thing where, you know, when we're making a for those watching News Channel 8, I'm losing my fingers. Like I'm typing on my phone. We need a word for that gesture. Right.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Good word.
You know, when the baseball game gets a little boring,
we call it ticking or talking, you know, either or.
I could find myself just on puppy videos alone going down this endless rabbit hole.
Oh, sure. For hours. You could do that.
Yeah.
For hours.
Yeah.
But you know what? People need to do things like that. I think we need to stop thinking of that as wasting time. People need comfort. You need comfort. Mm-hmm.
Oh, is that our comfort?
Your life. You can't just all be stress and angst and worry. Sometimes you just need to laugh or feel good about something for 5 minutes. It's okay.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. My buddy, I just got back from visiting some friends in Philadelphia. This isn't TikTok, it's YouTube. Apparently, he's like obsessed with YouTube now. And I don't really understand this, but he says he watched these videos of people, like they go up to somebody's house and the lawn is totally unkempt. And then they mow the lawn and they make it look nice.
Sure.
But it's like all the way through. It's like an hour long video and he watches it start to finish. And I'm like, what? That sounds insane. He's like, I know, but it makes me so happy and it calms me. You know, and I'm like, all right, man, wherever you find your peace, that's cool.
Yeah, no, there is a trend of a lot of popular YouTubers who do things like that. My son will he follows two specifically. And they do these things where they go to a grocery store. They take tape and they make a big circle. And they find some random person and says, anything you can fit in this circle in the next 30 minutes, we're going to pay for. And they gas giveaways. They've done car giveaways. Cool. They find people who are in need. Yeah. And so there's this kind of trend, to Mark's point, where there are folks doing that. But then you also have to navigate past the weirdos, which can be tough at times.
I think I may have said this before in the show, but when I hear something I don't know anything about, you know, armadillos. I'll go to my Google machine. I'll dutifully type in armadillos. Mm-hmm. And I look at the first five articles, whatever that come up. And then I might look at some videos, whatever. My 20-somethings, it would never occur to them. They're all about video. So if they're interested in something, I think YouTube is where they get a lot
Instagram,
of their.
Sure.
I asked my son Charlie the other day, who was staying with us. It was delightful. And it was the Sunday newspapers. And I love the Sunday newspapers. It's the one day I actually sit down and read them all the way through. And I said, when's the last time you ever read a newspaper? And he just looked at me and said, never.
Wow. Yeah.
Just not what he needs.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the generation.
Okay. Another author that we've had on, I believe that Mark Leibovich, formerly of the New York Times, now with the Atlantic, may have been the first author we ever had on. Hmm. He had a great book about the NFL called The Big Game.
Oh, yes.
And he's got one out now called Thank You for Your Servitude. And I told him, we might break our rule of not doing politics on this show by having him on, partly because I love Mark Leibovich, and partly because his book called Thank You for Your Servitude, Donald Trump's Washington and the Price of Submission is really about the so-called leading Republicans and how they just became completely enthralled with, submissive to, pick your words, Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And so it's about Lindsey Graham. It's about McCarthy. It's about these kinds of people. And I read an excerpt in The Atlantic, which was incredible. And I'm just going to read you. This is from the Washington Post review about this book. And Washington Post, no love lost for people formerly from The New York Times. It says, Leibovich is just so good at this. He is a world-class ranter, continuing an American tradition that includes such dyspeptic luminaries as H.L. Mencken, Hunter S. Thompson, and P.G. O'Rourke. He is a brilliant interviewer, able to wheedle not quite admissions from his subjects who give him all the access in the world. That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so we might have him on. What do you think, David? Have him on?
Sure. We can. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
We'll get lit up if anybody says anything remotely.
Of course we will. But we know that going in. It's okay.
Exactly. Okay.
Well, if you can't get those other three, P.J. O'Rourke, Hunter S. Thompson, or H.L. Mencken.
No.
You can't get them.
Exactly. Unfortunately, not available.
Yes, no signing. Yes.
Okay. Don't know if this woman is still available. Hunter S. Thompson had a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember her name, but was known for several things, including the fact that she had a giant tattoo on her back of, I believe, a spider. a giant spider. That person worked at some time back in the 80s, late 80s, in the Arizona State Legislature, an administrative person. Mm-hmm. And at certain times of year, when it was really hot, which is 10 months of the year in Arizona, if you happened to walk by that office, and she tended to wear, so a lot of people did because it was so hot, kind of filmy, loose tops, you could see the tattoo. And spider. That's how you knew that was Hunter S. Thompson's girlfriend. Closest I ever got to Hunter S. Thompson. Alex Kershaw joins us. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us. Okay. I don't know if it shows up on your screen the same way, Alex, but across the top, we have Claude Jennings, who does all the important work on the show. Mm-hmm. David Aldridge, who's with us for a little bit. So, David, any questions you have, you get to go first. And Mark Stern, who knows not as much about World War II as you do, but he knows a fair amount. So welcome. Thank you for joining us. Glad you could do this.
Yeah, I'm in a hotel in London, so I hope the lighting's okay.
Perfect. It's absolutely fine. Okay. We love, I was raving about you at the start of the show, Alex, and you really are the penultimate writer of all things World War II.
The penultimate or the ultimate?
Maybe by the end of the show, the ultimate.
I got one more book in me.
And I want to talk about that because I think I know what it's about. I think I read what it's about. But you're this nice guy from the UK. What was it about World War II? What is it? You know, did you have this obsession as a young child? Give us the backstory on you.
I'm only in England for a while. I'm coming back tomorrow to the US. I've been in the US for 28 years, so I don't want to sound like I'm a carpetbagger. But I actually walked down my mum's back garden, which was really beautiful. I mean, England is very beautiful right now. It's not too hot. Mm. And I walked past, at the end of the garden, I walked past what in World War II, there were some pigsties, you know, where they kept pigs because everybody in England during World War II had to grow their own food or, you know, having a pigsty was a big deal. You could actually have bacon. Point being is when I was a kid, I went down there to play. I used to go and stay there every summer and I would go and play in these pigsties. And for some reason, someone left a whole bunch of comics there. And one summer I was like 7, 8 years old and I discovered like 200 World War II comics in this pigsty. And they were like Commando, G.I. Joe would be the American equivalent. Commando was the big one over here in England. And I was obsessed. I read every single one. I was really bored. But I read every single one, and my mum said to me that she found me one day walking along the street, and she was really worried that I would walk into a lamppost because my head was buried in this comic. So I could be really pretentious and academic and intellectual and pseudo and tell you that there were lots of cultural, personal reasons for being really into World War II, and that would be true, absolutely true. But my fascination with World War two stories and the beauty of them and where I became entranced with World War II narratives was through comics when I was a kid.
Wow, that's great. We've had lots of authors on with lots of different inspirations, but never comics. That is great.
Yeah, no, they're amazing.
Do you still have them? Did you keep them?
I didn't, but you know, I wish I had because there was a really good story this week in the Daily Mail over here, how they've gone really woke. There's one comic left. I think it's called Commando, and it's gone really woke, and they want it to be like they don't want to have like Achtung and IE and you know, Take That Fritz and all that sort of stuff, which I love. But anyway, they wanted it to be a little bit more modern, which doesn't seem to make sense to me in terms of a World War II comic. But anyway,
of what it is,
they mentioned that one of the original comics in the 1960s. And actually in the 1970s, the readership peaked. So this is like way after the war. So there were 700,000 readers per week in Britain of a population of 55 million of this comic. And original comics are now like thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to buy.
Sure. Anyway, wow.
So,
Oh, that's fabulous. Okay, Mark, I've never asked you this. Where did Mark's into military history in general, but World War II in particular. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I was reading about World War II, I was like, well, I got to figure out some of the root causes of this. So then you start to dive into, you know, the First World War. And there's, again, you just get caught up in these just unbelievable stories that I know we're going to explore with Alex. I guess a lot of it was my father, because he had a great respect and an affinity for military history. So I sort of picked that up from him. And a lot of it was, you know, watching an Errol Flynn movie, you know, and then just sort of getting caught up like that. And yeah. I started reading about it. But it's funny that, Alex, that you bring that up, because the one time I've been to England, and I don't even know where we got these. I don't know where they are now. It kills me that I lost them. But we got these World War II comics, and they were these unbelievable stories. Yeah. And I still sort of remember loosely the plot. And this had to be in like 1979 when I read them. And they were the coolest things ever. And I hadn't really even thought about that until you just brought that up right now. So I guess it was sort of a phenomenon over there, because you can't really find those things here in the States. But that and it was just something that sort of just added to it. And then the more that I would dive into it, the more I would read, the more I wanted to, I wanted to learn, you know?
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is that I grew up in a culture and a country. I grew up in a country where everyone was obsessed. Pretty much everyone was obsessed with World War II. I mean,
with good reason.
And it was everywhere. I mean, I remember driving around London in the mid 70s to go to France with my dad, and my dad pointed out the window and he said, look at that. And there were still bomb craters in East London in the 1970s. Yeah. So you didn't have that in the US. So, you know, it's deeply embedded in the culture. And I think that every English schoolboy grew up hero worshipping RAF pilots, guys on D-Day. You know, there's this definite level of much more elevated fascination with the culture and the stories. I mean, I think that you'd find a much more, actually what's really encouraging too, is that younger generations, like people in their 30s, 40s, are really getting into World War II. They're into podcasts. They go to World War II festivals all over Britain. I mean, it's really healthy to see, you know, it's so embedded in the culture that it's just passed down naturally, you know?
Just nice. Hey, David, I know we only get you for a few more minutes, so why don't you go?
Yeah, no, I'm curious. Alex, thank you for joining us, first of all. A wonderful read. And we were just talking earlier about how people overcome fear and persevere, right? And I'm always fascinated by the notion that in times of war, I don't think that people are especially heroic. I think what makes them heroic is that they just do what they're supposed to do, because it's very hard to do what they're supposed to do. You know what I mean? But I don't think it's that they go above and beyond. It's that they just do what they're supposed to do. And it's incredibly hard to do that. And so I just wonder what you saw, or what you've discovered about each of these protagonists that allowed them to kind of persevere in incredibly stressful, incredibly dangerous situations that allowed them to simply focus and do the task and perform the task at hand and do it well?
It's a really good question. I mean, I do think that you're dead right about this notion of just performing a job, if you like. Not many people wanted to do it, obviously, and not many people were actually that good at it. I'll give you an example. In a firefight in Normandy in 1944 after D-Day, less than a third of American infantrymen would actually return fire when they were being fired upon. I mean, like, you know, if someone's firing at you and about to kill you, you'd think that you'd fire back, and they didn't. Right. We sorted that problem out with Vietnam, and definitely now people are trained to fire back. But these kids, and that's what they were, had grown up in a culture where killing was wrong. You know, they hadn't been trained to be that vicious. So, going to your point, there were people that did actually go beyond, that did the job and went beyond. And I think that what made them special was that they were very selfless. They were extraordinarily rare. And they realized that they had to do the job or someone else wouldn't do it. And that job was about saving other people's lives. When it comes down to combat, you might have, say, 200 men. It doesn't matter. Say 200 men in a company. That's an infantry company. you'll only ever have really maybe two or three, if you're lucky, guys that will actually go and be predators, if you like, that actually go of their own initiative, will go out and kill the enemy, will actually do what you're supposed to do in a war if you're going to win it on the ground, is to go seek out the enemy and kill them. Very few people will do that. And the ones that do it are extremely valuable and very important. And the reason why we give them medals, why the Medal of Honor is particularly important, is because it's a way of recognizing that extraordinary courage. But also, as you were saying earlier on, the fact that the vast majority of people don't do it. They don't want to do it. They're pretty sensible. They want to try and stay alive. And they certainly don't want to, you know, get themselves killed, which is what the guys I write about in this book, they were doing that every day. So, you know, it's a very special alchemy. It's a very, very strange thing. But I do know it's extremely rare, you know?
Yeah. And so check my numbers on this, Alex, but I think out of the millions and millions who have served over the years, something like 3,500 have received the Medal of Honor. Is that about right? 3,500, 3,600? So you could have focused on a lot of different people, but you picked, for this book, against all, you picked primarily four. So Audie Murphy, famous. Michael Daly, I think somewhat famous. Britt, the University of Arkansas, pretty well known. Michael Daly, I think a little bit less so. But what caused you to pick these four? Their stories in the book are incredible. To David's point, just absolutely insane what they did. And a lot of it was about keeping their men alive. But what caused you to focus on these four? Bye, David. Love you.
Well, I picked the third ID. I should say that there were 473 Americans that received the Medal of Honor for World War II. The last one just died 2 weeks ago, Woody Williams. So we have of the 473, there's no one left, which is a big deal. And I picked the third division, because it was the most decorated division in the European theater. So the third division out of 90 at the end of the war, in 1945, the 3rd Division had a tenth of all the Medal of Honor honors given in World War II. That's one out of 90 in the European theater, let alone the Pacific. And they had by far the most medals. They had the most casualties. They spent the longest in time in combat. They gave the most to liberate Europe, basically. And I became fascinated with the idea of, you know, why? How did that happen? What is the Medal of Honor about? What does it mean to actually earn it? How does it weigh heavily on you or not? And I chose the third ID because it just literally was, it had more guys that received that medal. So it was a really good culture to examine it. You know, if I was going to find anything out about the Medal of Honor, it would be within that catchment, that selection. I just chose the four guys that most interested me. I needed a hook. I needed a commercial hook for the book, which was obviously going to be someone like Murphy. People needed to, you know, he's well known, but I wanted to say something relatively new about him. I don't think I succeeded that well, but I did say a few things. But anyway, point being is I cherry picked four guys that I thought had very interesting lives before the war, extraordinary lives through the war, lived, which was a big deal because more than half of the Medal of Honor recipients died, and then had interesting lives afterwards. But and also that they intersected, their stories intersected. So they either met each other during the war or after. They fought together. Three of the guys fought in the same unit, the 15th Infantry Regiment of the 3rd ID. And also towards the end of the war, the press, certainly the 3rd ID newspaper, picked up on the fact that these guys had received so many medals. And they started to treat it almost like a sports story. Certainly Britt and Murphy.
Apologies for interrupting, but I didn't know anything about that. That was amazing that they treated it like a horse race almost, or a pennant race. And the men were aware of it. But and then this whole thing about points, and if you got some, but explain that because I'll get it wrong. But they knew that there was this competition underway for the awards, but to the men, the awards meant points, and points meant you got to go home, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and actually, the points for a Medal of Honor were no different to a Bronze Star. You know, so you could. You know, but Murphy said in March 1945, and he'd been in action since the 10th of July 1943. Most people would agree with me that he's the most decorated infantryman of World War II. Some people say of all time, but anyway, he wrote to his sister in March of 1945 and said, you know, if I bag the Congressional Medal of Honor, that'll give me 10 more points and hopefully I'll be able to come home sooner. So it wasn't about glory or any sense of competition for the guys. For Murphy, it meant 10 more points to come home, because the more points you had, they added up the points, and the more points you had, the quicker you came home. But for most of them, they were not conscious of any sense of wanting to win medals. I mean, I didn't come across any evidence that any of them set out to actually win medals. They actually just wanted to get the job done.
They almost seemed, I don't know if embarrassed is the right word, but they almost seemed embarrassed by it. And throughout the book and throughout their stories, when they were praised or they were interviewed or they talked about winning these awards, they would almost reflexively go to, but it's the guys that didn't make it home. And, yeah, I mean, you know, I just, you know, how they dole out medals is a funny thing. And it could have been anybody else or should have been somebody else. Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, don't get me wrong. They knew that by doing certain things, it might be possible that it might be likely that they would be recognized. But that was not their motivation. And definitely, I've never met anybody that received the Medal of Honor from World War II. And I've interviewed of the last five that were living over the last 3 or 4 years, I interviewed the last four, including Woody Williams, who just passed away two weeks ago. And none of them ever started off by talking about what they did in World War II. They always talked about where they were, the guys around them. They were always about saying, you know, the medal I wore when I received it, that was a symbol of the courage of other people that didn't get recognized. Yeah. I wear the medal because it draws attention to the unit that I belong to. And then they'd point to the patch they wore on their shoulder. Michael Daly said that, you know, he wore the medal somewhat reluctantly because he didn't want to draw attention to himself, but he wore it on behalf of the guys that he'd fought with because he was proud of the unit he belonged to. And if people talked about him, then he got to talk about the people that he fought with. So, I mean, these are people that are truly walked it. They don't have to talk it. You know, the medal's there. They don't have to say a thing. It's proof enough.
So there were so many stories about their bravery and their courage under incredible circumstances. I was thinking of Britt, who I didn't know a lot about, who was throwing in one of these battles, he was throwing grenades and he ran out of grenades. So he's throwing rocks. But you knew a lot about World War II. You knew a lot about these battles going in, some of those famous battles of all time. What did you learn? What surprised you? Did you hear anything or learn something about one of these guys? You went, oh my God, that's just incredible.
I think in every case, I was astonished by their resilience and their ability to just carry on functioning. That's the thing that surprised me.
Do you have a reason for that? Do you know was it adrenaline? What was it?
I think they were just really, really tough. They had very, very hard upbringings. They were forged before the war. I mean, they had been prepared for massive hardship because they'd lived through it in the already. Murphy, every single one of them, except for Michael Daly, who I think was motivated by slightly different things. But certainly of the four main characters, three of them had lost their father at a young age, all three of them, where Britt and Murphy, their father figure, had died when they were kids or in teenage. They'd gone through really strenuous poverty. They'd had to support their families. Mm-hmm. They'd had to work incredibly hard all their lives just to get by. They were products of the depression, etc. But they were tough. They'd suffered a lot of hardship emotionally and financially. I think they were very positive people. They were very optimistic. Mm-hmm. They were very hopeful. They had a great deal of compassion and love for other people. They liked their fellow human beings enough to be able to want to put their lives on the line and give their lives for them. But I think they were tough, they were calm, and I think they were warriors in the sense that they didn't have a problem with going out and finding the enemy and killing the enemy.
Yeah.
And we don't talk about this often, you know, this is not, you know, but to be honest, in war does come down to you receive a Medal of Honor because you went out and did something extraordinary. You went beyond the call, and yeah. often that meant actually killing as many of the enemy as you possibly could. Yeah. And that entails a certain bloodlust, and war does bring that out in some people, and these guys had it.
Yeah.
They didn't enjoy it, but they knew that that's how they would get home. The war would be over. As Patton said, your job is to go out and kill the enemy, not get killed by the enemy. The quicker you can kill the enemy, the quicker you can go home. And they knew that. So let's get the job done. And the job was advance, attack, be predators.
Yeah. Mark, it looked like you had a question.
Well, no, it just struck me, you think about the time period that they came out of. I mean, this is the Great Depression, and hard times build hard men, and just the upbringing that they had to go through. I mean, all the personal troubles, but this is what we're going through as a nation. And Alex, you could correct me if I'm wrong, because I very well might be, but I think the perception of the Americans going into the war, certainly from Germany's point of view, was that, well, the Americans are playboys and they don't really have the fortitude to stick it out. So we're not really concerned about them as fighters. And there was a lot of that. And I know in our initial combat, certainly in North Africa, it did not go well. But they really found a way to dig deep, and these heroes emerged. And like you said, I don't think it was them setting out saying, I'm going to go be heroic because I want to win a medal. Everything that I've always read, including in your unbelievably fine writings, is they were doing it for the guys next to them, was for their pals in their platoon or in their squad or in their regiment. And it was always about those guys. And I've always felt a certain sense of survivor's guilt from them, that they, why was I lucky enough to get through this? There were people that they considered to be better and braver than they were that didn't make it. And there was always somebody that they looked up to as that, well, that was the real hero of our troop or whatever. And for whatever the fickle fate, within combat, that some people make it and some people don't, it's, like you said, it's just the most amazing stories. And I know it's an overused phrase, it's the greatest generation, but I'm so glad that they have that name. And I know that they're rapidly dwindling, it's just a handful left really now, but as we go through hard times, and Lord knows we're in chaotic times right now globally, you want to look back to them. I certainly do, for inspiration. And I think you're right. They looked at it as, look, this is the job we got to do. And it was all about getting home. It was all about getting home, not so that they could get on. And we're just talking about TikTok, so they could get on TikTok and be famous and cash in. I know Audie Murphy went on that trail, but it was more about, I want to go back. I want to drive a cab. I want to go back and I want to eat a hot dog with my girlfriend, and things like that. And that's that simplicity of spirit for them is something I think that we overlook a little bit. And to me, that's the shining thing about them that impresses me and endears me the most,
Yeah, they were remarkable people.
They were also very young.
They were
young.
Kids.
Murphy
was
20, 21, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Murphy was 20 when the war ended, and he started when he was 18. So Michael Daly was 20 when he received the Medal of Honor. Britt was a bit older because he was an officer. But yeah, I mean, the average age by the time you get to like 1945, the average age is like 19, 20 on the front lines, because we're running out of men. We're taking kids straight out of high school. You graduated high school, you were drafted immediately. Maybe if you were lucky, given 2 or 3 months training, ended up as a replacement in the Pacific or in Europe.
Yeah.
They were very young. People forget that just how young they were. And they got younger as the war went on.
And many of them didn't have much training coming in. Again, one of the things that struck me, I should have thought of this before, but you have these guys like Audie Murphy, you have Daly, and you have others who had served for a while. And then because they're just throwing bodies at it, you get these young guys thrown in who had had very little training, and they were a danger. They were a liability for those around them. And there's a certain amount of resentment, wasn't there, of those who had been in there for a year or two and those who had just been thrown in with very little training.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if you had some hotshot, Stanford graduate or West Pointer that came in and, they're at 21, 22 and they start telling what they become like a lieutenant with, usually a second lieutenant or a first lieutenant would start off with maybe a platoon. That's 30 guys. Out of those 30 guys, there might be a few that have been alive if they're lucky for more than 3 or 4 months. And they're very worried. They're very worried. Who's this guy that, you know, is wearing the stripes that's telling me what to do. He hasn't got a clue. And they want to stay alive and they want to keep their buddies alive.
Yeah.
And there were examples in, you know, not just Normandy, in particularly in Normandy, but that I've come across anecdotal examples of where, you know, some arrogant college graduate would come in thinking they knew everything about war, and they wouldn't even take their stripes off. So they'd have the stripe on the helmet, the uniform, and guys would look at them. They'd think, oh, am I going to be alive tomorrow? And they wouldn't tell them to take off the stripe. So 2 or 3 days later, snap, sniper gets them. It's not like Vietnam where they actually had fragging, but it's kind of the same thing. Where,
sure. Yeah.
You don't want a guy that's going to get you killed, you know, leading you for too long. So, yeah. You know, if they're prepared to listen and learn, if they go and talk to the first sergeant, you know, actually sit there and go like, okay, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Who knows what they're doing? You go and talk to the first sergeant and you say, hey, by the way, privately, you say, by the way, what do you need me to do? What do I need to do to keep these guys respect? What do I, you know, just give me a few clues. The ones that didn't last very long, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, lean on the non-coms and the guys. I mean, that's where all the wisdom of everything was.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah. Those are the guys that win you firefights. Those are the guys that get the job done. They're
right.
The ones that win battles, you know?
Yeah.
If you look at D-Day, Omaha Beach, etc., it's a lot of non-coms.
Yes.
And a few officers that are actually basically, you know, getting guys to get up and do the job. But a lot of it was non-coms. A lot of it was like sergeants, corporals, you know, that actually, you know, got their platoons to do the job.
And Mark,
go ahead.
Wasn't there a certain amount too with replacements that you didn't want to get to know them because you don't want to invest any emotional energy in somebody that might, you know, that first of all, might not know what they're doing and might get you in trouble, but also might be gone in less than a day. You know, and so there was this closing off from the veterans of just like, so if you were a new guy coming out to the front lines, and I think a lot of like the Battle of the Bulge, when it was like a lot of replacement fighters, you're like, what the hell's going on out here? These Germans are pretty tough and it's cold and we got nothing. And you're sort of like on your own. And I think the guys that made it through that probably, you know, at some point, you know, blended in with the rest. But man, that had to be just incredibly tough to try and fit in.
Yeah, and you know, you have to think about it. You know, you're 18 years old. You just come, you know, you left the States. You know, you left high school. You went through maybe 2 or 3 months training max. You shipped into a replacement depot. You don't know anybody. You're really young. You're scared as hell. And then you get put on the front line and no one wants to talk to you. And you don't know what they're doing. You don't even know how to fire a rifle. You've never fired a rifle before in anger. You're in very, very harsh conditions and you're scared as hell and people don't really care, you know?
Okay.
If you last a week or two, you've got the best buddies you'll ever have in your life.
Yes.
But you got to last a week or two, you know?
Yeah.
One of the many things I loved about Against All Odds, Alex, was you really did give the before these battles, before they received the Medal of Honor and then after. And the last two chapters in the book are wonderful. And the medals weighed heavy on some of them. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, I don't think any of them wanted to be a public superhero. You know, they felt very uncomfortable about it. They had a lot of survivor's guilt, a lot of PTSD, all of them. They'd been through massive trauma. And I don't think they wanted the limelight to be on them. I think they wanted to, as you said earlier on, they wanted to deflect that. And also one of the things is that as a guy called Bob Maxwell, who was from the Third ID, he told me, I interviewed him. Mm. He said to me, he was wearing the medal at the time. He was 98 years old. He was the oldest living Medal of Honor recipient when I interviewed him. And he said, you know, this has weighed heavy on me. I can't get drunk in public. I can't get divorced. I can't get a speeding ticket. I can't be like everybody else. Everybody expects me to be perfect, you know? And he said, we are not perfect. We're like everybody else. In fact, he didn't say this, but what you discover is that people who've been through an enormous amount of trauma and have been through war and come back and have done seemingly crazy things, they're not that well balanced. They're damaged. So the likelihood that they would actually, you know, do something which might upset other people, or they might let themselves down, they're worried about that because they know that they carry a lot of anger, they carry a lot of grief, a lot of trauma. So I think the medal, they don't want to be in the public eye because they want to avoid scrutiny because they're suffering a lot of them, you know. And it made them feel very uncomfortable. Certainly with Michael Daly, he felt very uncomfortable. He didn't want to be wearing that medal in public. Murphy himself, you know, in the 1968 Esquire magazine, went to interview him, and he didn't even know where his medals were. You know, he'd given half his medals to the neighborhood kids. He's like, they didn't matter to him. You know, it didn't matter. You know,
talk a little bit about his somewhat uneasy entrance and success in the entertainment world.
Well, you know, in 1945. His face appeared on the front cover of Life magazine. So he became over.
Oh, yeah.
He's a good looking guy.
July of 1945, his face, very handsome young guy, you know. He did look like a movie star. And a real movie star spotted his face on the front of Life magazine. And the movie star was called Jimmy Cagney. Jimmy Cagney contacted Audie Murphy in Texas in September 1945. And he said, "You're a movie star, bud. Come out to Los Angeles." He paid for him to go out to Los Angeles, put him up in his pool house, paid for him to go to the gym because he looked terrible. Cagney said he looked like a ghost. He fattened him up, got him in a gym, paid for acting lessons, and then 1947, Audie Murphy starts appearing in B movies, and by the end of it, his career had been in over 30 westerns. To Hell and Back was his most successful movie, and that was the 1955 movie, which is based on his autobiography, To Hell and Back. He was a World War II genuine superstar that became a Hollywood star. Really remarkable, you know.
Made a ton of money.
Yeah, he made a lot of money. He gambled most of it away. I think his big addiction, you know, he wasn't an alcoholic. His big thing wasn't women, it was horses, you know, and he gambled a lot. And there were lots of stories about how much he owed to various people, including perhaps the mob. And he gambled because it was the only thing that gave him that rush, that adrenaline rush that he had in combat. You know, he said that he was looking for that kind of excitement. And after World War II, there's nothing that gave him that, you know.
Let me get that with this. I want to be respectful of your time. We can't ask you who was your favorite, because it's like asking the favorite child. But of the four that are prominently featured in Against All Odds, which one inspired you the most and why?
I think Michael Daly. I think because he, dropped out of West Point, was very motivated by the idea that he wanted to best his father. He wanted to be a hero like his father. His father was a very decorated, very respected World War II veteran, World War I veteran. And Michael Daly was very young. He was only 19 when he was on Omaha Beach on D-Day. He led 200 guys as an officer, A Company, 15th Infantry Regiment. That's a 19-year-old with 200 beating hearts under his command. Extremely courageous. His Medal of Honor was received for basically saving a lot of guys' lives right at the end of the war because he wanted his kids to go home, basically. He wanted the kids under his command to get a chance to live and go home. And he said that he never, ever found a cause that was as great as the one that he served in World War II. And he said that that cause is about something bigger than myself. He said, you know, everybody needs to have a cause in their life which is bigger than their ego, bigger than Facebook and TikTok and politics and all the superficial, absolutely infuriating fake division and distraction that we are inundated with both in American and British culture and elsewhere. He said that the true path to contentment is to serve other people, is to give yourself to a cause which is not about yourself. And he couldn't find one after World War II, which was as great as what he'd felt as a combat commander in World War II. But eventually he started working for a veterans hospital, gave a lot of his time, a lot of his energy, emotional energy, went to so many World War II veterans' funerals, etc. And he said that that's the lesson of my life. The lesson of my life is that you can only really feel supremely alive when you are serving other people. That if you want to be happy, want to be content. And this is a classic step of trauma survivors. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go through enormous trauma, which is war, war is not about heroism and medals, etc. It's about that, but it's mainly about trauma and killing people and seeing people die. So if you've been through, anybody that's been in a war has suffered trauma to some extent. They're damaged by it in some fundamental way. And one of the great things that his story taught me was that if you want to get over a very, very bad experience, if you want to survive and start to prosper after trauma, one of the best things you can do is to go and help other people, because it takes you away from your own suffering. It takes you away from your own pain. And it puts you in a place which is about other people's pain, other people's suffering, and trying to alleviate other people's misfortunes. And the more you do that, the more that you will start to recover from your own experiences. So I think that, to answer your question, that was the most inspiring guy, because I think that's a lesson that we can all ponder, and we should all act on. You know,
it's fabulous. And I'm not going to subject you to 60 seconds more, which we normally subject a lot of authors to, including, I think, Eric Larson. It's just too embarrassing. But let's ask you this. So you have this fabulous book, Against All Odds. You have the book about Robert Capa, the photographer. Incredible. The Bedford Boys. Mark, you and I have talked about the Bedford Boys a few times.
Yep.
In Virginia. What's next?
I'm writing a book about Patton at the Battle of the Bulge, which has probably been done like so many times, but I'm, you know, my publisher asked me to do something about Patton and the Battle of the Bulge. And so it's kind of blow by blow, minute by minute account of Patton at his finest hour. Mm-hmm. Patton, his greatest chapter in his very interesting history is the Battle of the Bulge. So through those 3 or 4 weeks, I'm trying to animate him as a very complex human being. He is the movie, the famous movie, but he's a lot more than that. He's actually very, very, very highly complex, interesting, really attractive human being in many ways. You know, I mean, I admire him a great deal because he was so complex and egotistical and vain and courageous and beloved and hated. But we needed certain people at certain times to do remarkable things.
Right.
And he, at that one point in his life, did something that was truly remarkable. And that was to inspire other people to do remarkable things, mm-hmm. and to show those people how to do it by doing it himself. So,
right.
You know, third army commander in charge of 250,000 guys, who's actually in a Jeep every day at the front, near the front lines, telling 19-year-old GIs how to get the job done. And I found that very, very interesting, you know.
When do you think that will be out?
He had a great sense of humor. He had a fantastic sense of humor. So, you know, so often we read history books and World War II history, and so we've lost our sense of humor. You know, people have forgotten how to laugh. You know, we don't laugh enough when we talk about serious subjects, and we should, because, you know, we're not in World War II. We're not being fired upon. We're not losing all our friends. But we live in a
zooming.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, we're zooming. We're not. People are worried about TikTok and Twitter and stuff. It's like, we're not, you know, the nation's survival is not at stake right now. You know, it's not. We're not in a life or death struggle. So it's remarkable when I look at World War II and I look at people like Patton and I look at the stories, it's remarkable how much of a sense of humor these people had to have and had, and how useful it was and how inspiring it could be. You know, people needed to joke. They needed to have moments. They needed to have people that had a sense of humor and could inspire them. And Patton, of any World War II leader, American combat leader, had the best sense of humor I've come across, you know.
And will the title of the book be Patton? He really was a funny guy. What's the
the comedy stylings of George Patton? Yeah.
Come back when you get that book done. Please come back, Mark.
Before you go, Alex, thank you for everything that you have done and that you will continue to do. I want to highlight three books. I mean, I could do all of them, but The Few, The First Wave, and I think it's Escape from the Deep. Was that?
Yeah.
Yes, that's the title. Yes. Yeah. And they're just deep dives into fascinating facets of the Second World War, and nobody does it better. It's just, this is such a thrill and honor for me to get to chat with you right now. Thank you so much.
Great fun to talk to people that really care about what I care about, you know?
Oh, we love it. I think we can call you the ultimate World War II writer.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On that penultimate note, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks everybody for listening. We're back next week with Zane Asher, who was sick a couple weeks ago, to talk about inspirational and amazing woman. In the meantime, I hope everybody stays cool, stays well, and thank you for listening. Thanks, Claude.